sin negis tan el tri haya de bau tekle.
We learn from this film that this amnesty program is quite inspirational. How does it transform the lives of Aurelia Mutanda, Lee?
Well, I mean, you know, until this program comes in, they are very aware that they're living a very precarious, you know, highly dangerous existence, and one that they're very clearly both uncomfortable with. You know, it does involve, they don't answer it directly, but you very much get the sense that they've been involved in deaths, and obviously they've had loved ones or friends die as well. So it's just a really unpleasant, you know, precarious existence. So this government program is really trying to give people a kind of a firmer foothold in, I guess, you know, quote-unquote, the right direction. So taking them away from sort of illegal activities, illegal guns, and trying to sort of, you know, push their energies and their sort of, their outlook in a more kind of positive and, you know, peaceful direction. So that's a great thing.
And Tete, the film sheds a positive light on this amnesty program. How effective is it really? And can you talk more a bit about this?
Well, there are a couple of things which come out. For a program to work, you've got to be able to transfer skills which are being adversely used or not constructively used into something which is positive. And in the way the story pans out with these two characters, Mutanda is very much the organizer. I mean, he had 500 effectively gangsters, hoodlums, they call themselves rustlers, under his charge. So this guy's a people organizer. Of course, he's the one whose skills are now deployed in the political arena, actually getting people involved with the program, even campaigning for a parliamentary candidate. And he says he himself has parliamentary aspirations. Then Aurelia, on the other hand, is the rising star, the hugely talented individual. They said that even as a kid, he was winning things at the local level. So his skills, his competitive drive, is now being, you know, applied in an arena which can actually make him money, improve the quality of his personal life, the life of his family, and so on. And it does say that a lot depends on the quality of government, the environment you provide. These talents are available in bad neighborhoods, and they're available in the right postcodes. The difference is that in the right postcode or a stable environment, those talents are able to flourish because they are positively deployed. So in terms of this gun amnesty, Kenya had a problem. I think it was a blindingly inspired idea. It's one of the funniest quotes I actually picked up from this was he said, well, the skills I need to run to chase, to rustle, are to chase. I need to be able to run fast to chase cattle, and I need to be run fast to escape the police. And he's doing that with a marathon.
That's exactly the point of this film, is that violence goes hand in hand with their ability to be good athletes. Yeah. And Lee, if I could ask you, an issue that is raised in this documentary is that when you have a gun, you have a sense of power. So it seems as if it's an accepted reality or part of life in Kenya.
There's an amazing quote, and to be honest, it's the thing that probably stayed with me most from this film. I think it's Mutanda who's talking. He's like, you know, if you haven't killed someone, if you haven't stolen their property, then what kind of a warrior are you? And to me, this is really then what they're actually really trying to do underline is change the whole paradigm of what makes a warrior or actually a man. And actually, that's something that is a huge, that's not just particular to this country. It's something we probably all need to look at in, you know, different societies, the way we construct masculine identity. And it shouldn't be about trying to dominate and power and, you know, impose yourself. And I think actually, they don't explore that anymore, sadly, I felt in this. Mm. But the fact that he vocalizes it shows that actually it's making him reconsider what, you know, as a warrior he should be doing. And then the fact that he goes into more sort of, you know, political and sort of socially constructive things is obviously helping that situation.
So I know you'd like to jump in, but we're just going to pause just for a second as we take a look at another clip from Gun Runners, which shows Robert Mutanda tell us about the significance of marathon running.
When I was in the bush, I used to run. That's why when I came here, I didn't find it difficult when I started to run. Because I was running even 100 kilometers. You know, when the police is chasing you, also you chase the cattle. So you chase very fast. But if you chase very slowly, the police will capture you. And then you will be in a hot soup. outside, the people are running. Town breathes, eats, sleeps, imagines, fantasizes, athletics. The odds 1 out of 10 that you can make money out of it. And 1 in 50 to really make money out of it and start really changing your life. The luck of getting a manager that supports you and brings you to races for around a 15% commission is crucial. There is a big boulevard of broken dreams here in Italy. A big one, a big, big, big one. But some people walk over the boulevard of broken dreams, still thinking they can make it.
I found both characters to be quite endearing, but I think Matanda was the more charismatic one out of the two. And we get the sense that he had a much darker past than Arile. There was a moment when he was asked how many people he's killed, and he just looks off camera and remains silent, which is quite chilling to watch. Lee, what did you make of Matanda's character compared to Arile's?
Yeah, I mean, one of the strengths of the film is that they are very different, so you have that immediate contrast. And Tete's, you know, described it very well. Matanda's the sort of more social, you know, political animal. He has a natural ability and affinity to kind of, you know, draw people in. Arile is much more kind of, you know, quieter, more sort of focused on his own sort of goals. And so that, I think, is one of the main strengths of the film, because as you follow their paths, you find that actually they diverge more than you might expect, because actually they aren't equally talented runners. So then one storyline really pursues the actual running side of it, and the other goes, I would say, into equally or maybe even more interesting avenues about, well, if you can't do that, it's not just, you know, guns or running. Actually, if the running is not going to be your career, you can use your skills in different ways, and I think that's a very interesting.
And we see Matanda pursue politics, but then of course we learned that it seems to be a corrupt world, and it's almost he embraces it and talks about it openly. Tete, is this a reality of life in Kenya?
It's a reality of life in Kenya, and not just Kenya, a lot of African countries. It's also the reality of life over here, but it's because there's a lot more wealth, and because ordinary people's needs are taken care of on a day-to-day basis, you don't see it as starkly. But in Kenya, it's very clear. I mean, he threatens the politician that if you don't make me, you know, minister in charge of security, which he patently won't be able to hold, he wouldn't be able to hold that position. He said he'd mobilize things against him. But what it says to me is that these individual talents are kind of drawn into this prism of organization, be it the sport, be it politics, be it whatever. And it is the quality of the organization that can absolutely, you know, enable them or absolutely destroy them.
And I want to touch quickly on the point about guns. We find out in this documentary also that there's 500,000 illegal guns in Kenya. I mean, where are they coming from and why are they there?
Well, I mean, there was a breakup of the Soviet Union, and that led to a huge kind of splurge of small arms all over the world. And, of course, these things are what are required to create kind of little lordships in all of these different countries. And it is one of the saddest statistics of African life that where there are the greatest resources, you have the greatest conflicts. So a country like the Congo, which is incredibly wealthy, has had internecine strife for near on 40 years consecutively. Of course, while that happens, the natives can't benefit from the resources in their land, but other agents do. And unfortunately, it is often foreign agents who enable these weapons to get into the hands of these people, and so that it's almost a system of divide and rule. But of course, you know, if you're a politician in Africa and you're accepting bribes from foreign agents to create conflict and strife in your own country, that's a decision only you can make. Nobody holds a gun to your head to do that. So it comes to issues around personal integrity and so on and so forth.
That's a really interesting point, but I'm afraid we'll have to move on just for the time being.
My name is Julius Arile from Kenya. 6 years ago, being a warrior, fighting with another people from our country. But this time now, I am an athlete, and I can run a marathon.
It really does need to make a breakthrough. The And if he doesn't have it, then it's going to be harder to fulfill this kind of dream of being in New York as an elite, top elite athlete that could maybe make it in the top five.
Good morning and welcome to Prague, Czech Republic, for the 19th running of the Volkswagen Prague Marathon.
A great race started in Prague's old town square in this historic city.
Is very much the underdog character in this documentary, and you really find yourself rooting for him. He has a lot of pressure on himself to prove himself, and he dreams of being on the wall, as he says, of all the top runners of Kenya. And we see him come seventh place in the first race, and then, but then do really well in the second opportunity he has. What did you make of this sort of triumphant arc he had?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I guess when you're choosing your characters to focus on at the beginning of your journey, you have no idea, actually, are they going to make it? So I think it's less, it sounds a cliche, but it's less about the destination than the journey. It's fascinating to follow this particular man on his sort of athletics career. Now, if he, you know, ends up winning a gold medal at the Olympics, even more extraordinary. But actually, I find it more interesting when you see the real struggles and the person who isn't necessarily going to be the ultimate victor in this. The film really made me think about an American documentary called Hoop Dreams from the 1990s, which followed two young inner-city kids who wanted to be basketball stars. Now, neither of them end up making it, but what you get is a fascinating portrait of their environment and the world that they're in and the politics and the social disadvantages, and actually, that's a more illuminating and, I think, more fascinating storyline than just, you know, the underdog who comes from nowhere to, you know, in the last minute, you know, storms to the front and wins the medal. That's interesting, but I'm more interested in the sort of the world that they're, that shapes their, you know.
Of course, he's plagued by poverty and injuries and not the same opportunities. Tete, I see you agreeing with Lee there?
Yeah, but absolutely, the journey's fascinating. And none of these characters are pristine. Got somebody pregnant when she was quite young. It led to her suicide and led to him becoming a warrior. But later on, he's now got three wives and children by all of them. So if he's not able to take that, put each one of his problems in some kind of compartment, he won't be able to pursue his dream. So these dreams are always fraught. And actually, the story, as you say very well, is the compromises, you know, the calls that each person has to make to pursue what it is that they're really after, and an illumination of the environment within which all of this is going on.
I want to talk now about the parallels we see between Kenya and the US, sort of the Western world. Lee, what did you make of their journey, of Relay's journey to New York, and sort of the observations and comments he was making?
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's very much sort of fish out of water stuff, right? So, you know, where they've grown up, where they live, what they're used to is obviously a world away from, you know, the slightly more glamorous, the more professional, the more kind of money at stake world that they go into. But I think, again, what's really interesting is in their own world as well, you see the way that they're not quite fitting in and the problems that they have. And to be honest, I would have liked the film to touch more on that. Like Tete says, they have these very checkered family lives. That's not really grappled with in the way that I would have, you know, appreciated a bit more. And I feel that, you know, of course the thread is the running and the marathon and what happens, but actually to get to know them even a bit more as characters and get a sort of a more rounded portrait of them, I would have liked to hear more about those sort of difficulties with the families and the wives and the kids, because it obviously has an impact. He wants to earn money so he can go back and provide for them, but we don't necessarily get, you know, the full story about what that entails.
And Tete, isn't it quite sad, though, that this notion of success, we see Arile move to sort of a shack-like accommodation, and he thinks he's living in a European city. Why is that this connection of success is linked to Europe and the West?
Well, success is always relative to what you've got. I mean, this guy wasn't having three baths a week out in the bush, and he's suddenly in a shack with running water. I mean, that's luxury. He might as well, from his point of view, be at the Ritz Hotel. So it's absolutely relative. But what I think it's important for people to also think about is the fact that this can be quite corrupting. This kind of drive to live in that star-spangled environment can be quite corrupting. because we all know that the industry that he's now becoming a part of, the elite athletics industry, is also incredibly corrupt.
Which is mainly dominated, sort of, as we see, by Western physiotherapists and management types.
So it's incredibly corrupt. So it's really a story about how, you know, man has to try and make it, making moral judgments at every turn of the way in a not-so-easy world.
I'm afraid we'll have to leave it there, gentlemen. Thank you very much for joining Doc Review. And that's it for this episode of Doc Review. Thank you to both my guests and to you. I've been Camila Shambayati.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
Hosseiniya. To his path from IRIB English Radio.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim wa bihi nasta'in.
Dr. Fakhr Rohani.
In the beginning, I should like to express my condolences on the 8th day of Muharram al-Haram. In this episode of the program Hosseiniya, we are going to review some of the senses and important phrasings in the speeches and letters of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam. As we know, Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam had dispatched his cousin and deputy and delegate to al-Kufa, Muslim ibn Aqil. However, Muslim ibn Aqil was arrested and martyred. He was beheaded in the city of al-Kufa. And that news reached Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam when Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam was heading for al-Kufa. Then Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam, after that, Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam wrote a short letter in this way. In the name of Allah, the compassionate, the merciful. Now to our topic. Indeed, a distressing piece of news has reached us. Muslim ibn Aqil, Hani ibn Urwa, and Abdullah ibn Yaqtur have been murdered, and our followers have forsaken us. Hence, any of you who may wish to return can go back. There's no longer any commitment to us on you. This is a very important aspect in the life of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam. He had dispatched Muslim al-Aqil to al-Kufa. And since Hani ibn Urwa was a staunch Shiite over there, and he used to cooperate with Muslim Naqil, Hani ibn Urwa was also arrested and beheaded, martyred, in the city of al-Kufa. Both Muslim Naqil and Hani ibn Urwa were killed on the same day, on the day Arafah, the 9th of the Hijjah. now we find that as soon as this distressing piece of news reached Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam, he announced it to his companions that his companions were no longer committed to him. Why? Because in his movement, Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam wanted people to join him quite knowingly, cognizantly. Consider that in the army dispatched by Ubaydullah ibn Ziyad from al-Kufa to Karbala under Umar ibn Sa'd, many of those people, of those soldiers, were urged to go to Karbala to kill Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam. However, Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam never urged any of his companions to remain with him. This gesture shows that Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam was the right Imam. He was the Imam of morality, the Imam of high moral and ethical standards. And it shows that in his movement, Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam wanted to give the right information and guidance to people, in contrast to the Umayyads, who used to force everybody to cooperate with them. We find that Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam, in his movement, was suggested to withdraw or to change his view. However, Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam gave this instruction to everybody that obtaining the consent, obtaining the pleasure of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala was by far the most appropriate way to choose. Then Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam addressed those people who had gathered over there around him, suggesting him to change his course of movement. He indicated it in this way: O people, indeed, if you observe piety and are cognizant of the right for and with its holders, it will be more desirable to Allah, and that we are the Ahlul Bayt of the Prophet Muhammad, upon whom and his progeny may Allah bestow graces. Hence we are more deserved to superintend this affair, that is leadership, rather than those claimants, that is the Umayyads and others, who have been committing crimes and increasing animosity. And if you were reluctant to us and ignorant for our right, and if your view at present is different from that when your letters reached us, I shall leave you. Now we find that Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam, in his movement, showed that even if those people who had earlier written to him letters of invitation, later on they changed the views, Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam was ready to return. However, we find that, morally speaking, the Umayyad army and the Umayyad hegemony was determined to slay Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam in order to put an end to the fate of the Islamic religion. Of course, this was just a false ambition they had. But we find that Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam never urged anybody to join him or to remain with him. On the other hand, we find that the Umayyads urged everybody to fight for them, and they urged Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam and kept him as a captive over there. Thank you.
The limelight. Germany added the United States to its high-risk area list and will soon tighten entry restrictions for unvaccinated travelers who had recently been in the United States. Starting Sunday, 15th of August, travelers who have recently spent time in the U.S. will need to be fully vaccinated or demonstrate an important reason for entering Germany. Those who are unvaccinated or unable to show proof of recovery will need to self-isolate for 10 days upon arrival. The quarantine period can end on the fifth day with proof of a negative COVID-19 test. The article you're about to hear has been written by journalist Bailey Schultz, writing for USA Today. The piece is titled, Germany Tightens Travel Restrictions on U.S. as COVID-19 Cases Surge. Germany added the United States to its high-risk area list and will soon tighten entry restrictions for unvaccinated travelers who had recently been in the U.S. Starting Sunday, 15th of August, travelers who have recently spent time in the U.S. will need to be fully vaccinated or demonstrate an important reason for entering Germany. Those who are unvaccinated or unable to show proof of recovery will need to self-isolate for 10 days upon arrival. The quarantine period can end on the fifth day with proof of a negative COVID-19 test. Previously, unvaccinated travelers had to show a negative coronavirus test to enter Germany. The change comes as the U.S. faces its fourth wave of COVID-19, driven by the highly contagious Delta variant. The country reported more than 900,000 new COVID cases in the past week, and nearly 52% of its population vaccinated, according to data from Johns Hopkins University. Turkey and Vietnam and other countries were also added to Germany's high-risk list, joining destinations like the United Kingdom, Spain, India, and Mexico. Germany has been open to tourists from the United States since 20th of June, shortly after the European Union added the United States to a list of countries it believed could see the gradual lifting of travel restrictions. The recommendation is not binding, and each country in the European bloc can enforce its own travel restrictions. The European Union has yet to remove the United States from its safe travel list, despite the U.S. maintaining a travel ban on most European countries. Restrictions against the European Schengen area were first implemented in March of 2020 and prevent travel to the United States for most people from major European countries such as France, Germany, Italy, Greece, Netherlands, Belgium, Denmark, Austria, Sweden, Norway, Hungary, and others. German Chancellor Angela Merkel pressed President Joe Biden on the travel ban during a meeting last month. Biden said at the time that his team was reviewing the travel restrictions, but no changes have been made. The administration certainly understands the importance of international travel. Jeff Zients, White House COVID-19 response team coordinator, said during a press briefing last week. But given the prevalence of the Delta variant of the coronavirus, the United States will maintain the existing travel restrictions at this point. Meanwhile, the United States has no plans to lift travel restrictions for travelers arriving from Europe. The decision means the country's current travel restrictions, which deny entry for people from the European Schengen area, as well as people from the United Kingdom and other countries, will remain in place. Given where we are today with the Delta variant, we will maintain existing travel restrictions at this point for a few reasons, White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki said at a recent press briefing. Jen Psaki added, the more transmissible Delta variant is spreading both here and around the world. Driven by the Delta variant, cases are rising here at home, particularly among those who are unvaccinated and appear likely to continue in the weeks ahead. When asked if President Biden would drop travel restrictions in the event airlines adopted vaccine passports or vaccine mandates, Jen Psaki said on Friday, "There are ongoing working groups focused on how to reopen international travel into the United States. There are a range of topics in those discussions that are ongoing," Jen Psaki added. "The president receives regular briefings on them, but we rely on public health and medical advice on when we're going to determine changes to be made." Travel industry groups have urged the Biden administration to open international travel. The Delta variant of the coronavirus now accounts for about 83% of cases nationwide and has led to a spike in U.S. COVID-19 cases. In the last 2 weeks, cases have increased 171% nationally, and the death rate is up 19% over the week before.
وقضى ربك ألا تعبدوا إلا إياه وبالوالدين إحسانا.
Your Lord has decreed that you shall not worship anyone except Him, and He has enjoined kindness to parents.
Humanity.
Sayyid Abdullah Al-Musawi.
A'udhu billahi min ash-shaytan ar-rajim. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad. Brothers and sisters, dear listeners, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. And welcome to IRIB English Radio, and you are listening to the program For Humanity. So we are still trying to learn from the universal lessons of Karbala and of Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam. In the movement of Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam, he is trying to teach us that not only should we not support injustice and oppression, but in fact, we need to stand against it too. So there has to be what? A movement, not just an idea that, yeah, I hate it. Obviously, I don't like anyone who's oppressing people. That's obvious. Well, this is a human nature. We hate anything that is bad. But the Imam says, you need to do what? To stand against it, no matter how powerful the enemy might be. Because Imam Hussein salamullah alayhi was him and handful members of his family and few of his friends who stood up against the entire nation, basically. So he was in Karbala, he was 72 compared to 32,000. That's not a comparison, you know, to begin with. That's a massacre in itself. But the Imam says not to support injustice and oppression, but you need to rise against it, even if it is what? Against the most powerful nation or powerful army or what have you that exists at the time or in your time. So when we commemorate the martyrdom of Karbala and the martyrdom of Imam Hussein alayhi salam, this still exists in our current time. The events, they still exist to our time, because many people say to us, why do you cry every year? Why do you beat your chest every year? Why do you, you know, sit and remember Imam Hussein every year? Because the problem is continuous. It did not stop with Imam Hussein alayhi salam. It's always continuing. And we always need to continue on the path of Imam Hussein alayhi salam. Therefore, we need to what? Stand up in the same way Imam did. Give you example. What Yazid was and his army was, they were technically speaking, in our terminology today, they were terrorists because they were there just to kill people and take the rights of others. And how many terrorists do we have today? We have terrorists just like Yazid was. We have ISIS, Boko Haram, and we have, you know, so much names. Qaeda, I don't know, and then continues. And these people are killing innocent Muslims and innocent lives in the name of Islam. And this is exactly what Yazid did. He was killing innocent people in the name of Islam. He says, well, the Prophet says, if you have a ruler, even if he's unjust, you have to obey him. Such nonsense. So they were killing people in the same way that these people that we have today, you know, they say we are Muslims, but they are killing innocent people. So the picture is exactly the same. The names are different, but the picture is exactly the same. And now we have even more, you know, smarter terrorists, because terrorism, sometimes it's a new face, a gun and a bullet. Sometimes now it's politics. When you see what America is doing and the American allies are doing, the bullying nations and the starving, you know, going on mass starvation of nations, this is also a form of terrorism that me and you need to stand against. So when the Imam Salamullah alayhi says that you need to not only, you know, to show that you do not support oppression and you don't support injustice, but you in fact need to stand against it, because it will continue. You know, you would have groups, you would have people, would have this ideology that me and you need to stand up against. And to give you examples that we can even relate to between Karbala and our current times, that we can see the similarities. But before we do that, let us take a short break and then we come back.
Dear listeners, you are listening to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. You can send us your emails, comments, and questions at englishradio@irib.ir.
Welcome back, brothers and sisters, and you are listening to IRIB English Radio and listening to For Humanity. So Imam Hussein Salamullah Alayhi, on the day of the 10th of Muharram, when he stood to pray and he asked them to give him, you know, time to pray, because it was the time for prayer, the enemies, you know, after trying to discuss with themselves, they said, you know what, let him pray. As the Imam started praying, the enemy started showering the Imam and his followers who were praying with him with arrows, right? They started trying to kill the Imam as he prays. This is the savagery of these people. They had no humanity left in them. Now, that was 61 Hijri. That was over 1,000 years ago. Come back to our time. We see that there are terrorist groups who would come with vests loaded with explosive, and they blow themselves up in the places of worship, because to them they are infidels. And they go and with cars, and they blow themselves in mosques and Husayniyat and even in markets, killing innocent people. The picture is exactly the same. Nothing has changed. Killing is killing. The method changed from shooting arrows at the Imam or coming up with an explosive vest or a car. So this is in self, in one way, when it comes to the Muslims killing those who they claim to be infidels. If you look at the West, they're doing the same thing, but instead of shooting arrows at you, you have drones killing you where you have no idea what's happening. They go to whoever they want, they kill whoever they want with their drones, and no one can say anything. So the same problem that existed over 1,400 years ago, it still exists today, but in a different name, in a different format. So the Imam Salamullah Alayhi says, you need to stand up, obviously never support injustice and oppression, no matter how powerful the enemy is, and no matter what incentive you're going to get, but in fact you need to do what? You need to stand up, you need to rise up, and you need to fight. Fight these powers, fight these people, fight these oppressions. Because most of the times people will say to you, well, you know, just mind your own business. Well, we say, this is our business. Humanity is my business. To fight against tyrants is my business. This is exactly what the Imam Salamullah Alayhi did in Karbala. He didn't say, well, you know, I don't care. I just want to, you know, live comfortably. He says, no, humanity, human rights is in fact my business and your business. It's not just, you know, for other people. So this is the universal message of Imam Hussein Salamullah Alayhi, that you need to make the pain of others your pain. You need to make the suffering of others your suffering. You can't just say, I don't care, it's not my business, I don't want to get hurt. You can live that kind of life, but this is the life of servants. This is the life of those who are enslaved to their desires and to their passions. But humanity itself, human rights, it is our business, and we need to make our voice heard, even by verbally or even with force, if we have to take our rights back from those who are oppressors, those who are tyrants. We leave it here, and we continue in episodes to come. Until then, stay with us. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
صل يا ربي على طه الأمين رحمة أرسلته للعالمين وعلى آل النبي أجمعين فبهم نرجوك أحسن ختمنا.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran.
Muharram Special. In the name of God, Salam and welcome to the program. Imam Hussein was a perfect manifestation of the good virtues and an ultimate example of the Prophet of Islam. His characteristics fully demonstrated that he had been trained by his noble grandfather, Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. Among his features was his love of worship, prayer, and supplication to God. God says in the noble Quran, "They used to sleep a little during the night, and at dawn they would plead for forgiveness." Dua-e Arafah or Arafah supplication of Imam Hussein is a clear example of his lofty cognizance and deep love of God. He speaks with God in part of this supplication, saying, "My Lord, what has found he who lost you, and what has lost, who has found you? Certainly, he who was content with other than you is a loser. And he who has turned away from you would be harmed." On the afternoon of Tasu'a, or 9th of Muharram, Umar Sa'd ordered for attacking Imam Hussein's encampment. Imam Hussein, peace upon him, told his valiant brother, Hazrat Abbas, to get respite from Umar Sa'd. Thus, the war was postponed for the following day. The Imam told Hazrat Abbas, "Brother Abbas, may I be sacrificed for you?" ride on your horse towards them, and if you can postpone the war till tomorrow morning and keep them away from us for tonight, perhaps we can engage in prayer and seeking for forgiveness with our Lord. He knows well that I love praying, reciting the Quran, supplicating much, and seeking for forgiveness at his court. Imam Hussein, peace upon him, told his companions, on the day of Ashura, Almighty God has been content with my martyrdom and your martyrdom on this day. So be resistant and fight. Imam Sadiq, peace upon him, said, recite Surah Fajr in your prayers as it is the Surah of Hussein ibn Ali, peace upon him. And whoever recites it will be at Hussein's degree on the day of resurrection. Interestingly, Fajr means dawn and light in Arabic. Imam Hussein, peace upon him, was like a light that radiated during the time of darkness of Umayyad rule to show the right path to its seekers. Asceticism and lack of attachment to the material world was another characteristic of Imam Hussein, peace upon him. He told his companions on the day of Ashura, O sons of the noble, be steadfast and know that death is just a bridge which passes you through from suffering and hardship into the vast and eternal paradise. Who does not want to be transferred from a prison to a palace? And this death for your enemies is like being transferred from a palace to a prison and place of torture. My father quoted me from the Prophet that the world is the prison of the faithful and the paradise of the faithless. And death is a bridge which takes the faithful to paradise and the faithless to the hell. The dignity of Muslims depends on accepting the system that the Prophet had designed. But the people like Yazid changed the course of government and turned it into a factor for the Muslims' humility. Clearly, Imam Hussein's goal of the uprising was to bring back God's will to the society and empower his religion. That's why the only way for him was to fight. He chose the best way to salvage God's religion, and finally, he lost his life in this way. The Imam became the manifestation of the concluding ayahs of Surah Fajr, where they read, O soul at peace, return to your Lord pleasing. Then enter among my servants and enter my paradise. According to the hadith, exegetes believe that my paradise here means God's special paradise, which has been prepared for the choicest among his servants. Surely, Imam Hussein, peace upon him, is among the loftiest servants of God.
This is A to Z. Today's lesson, the test begins. Ubaydullah proceeded to Kufa immediately, and on the very first day of his arrival in the city, he addressed the people and spoke about the kindness as well as harshness of Yazid. So he, in other words, threatened the people. He summoned the chiefs of the tribes and various classes of the society and behaved very harshly towards them. Now the people of Kufa reached the stage at which the number of supporters of truth diminishes and that of the followers of falsehood increases. The Almighty Allah says in the Holy Quran, chapter number 29, verse number 2 and 3, "Do people think that they will not be tested because they say, 'We have faith'? We tested those who were before them. Thus Allah knows those who are truthful and knows those who are liars." Brothers, just the mere claim of being the supporter of the Imam of your time is not going to suffice. History tells us that those who made mere claims and they were not ready to support the Imam and his movement and righteousness, they fell off the cliff. They gave up the challenge. As soon as the difficulties kick in, because they were not prepared, because they were not committed, they left the righteousness alone. So remember that Allah is going to test us. There is no way in the world that Allah is not going to test a few of us and test the others. If the prophets and imams were tested, if the believers before us were tested, what makes us so different from them that we're not going to be tested? So be prepared for that test.
Why is my heart set on fire when I hear your name?
As-salamu ala baik, ya Aba Abdullah.
Welcome back to your listeners. Today we are discussing how the test began in the time of Imam Hussein alayhi salam, and we are drawing some conclusions from it. One of the lessons that we get from the story of Imam Hussein alayhi salam and that reality that transpired and occurred in the past is that the truthful are those persons who stick firmly, even at the time of test and trial, to what they have said and assessed. Fear and desire do not dissuade them from the truth, which they have recognized. Nothing can place them among the supporters of falsehood. Unfortunately, we live in times where fear sometimes overcomes our decision-making strengths and our decision-making process. This fear has a lot of strong footprint in our decision makings. Remember that when it comes to the fight between truth and falsehood, take fear out and then make a decision. With fear being part of your decision making process, most likely you are going to abandon and leave alone the truth. Lesson number two, the liars are those who really speak the truth and correctly distinguish between truth and falsehood before they are involved in the difficulties of divine test and think themselves to be the supporters of truth and the enemies of falsehood and say that they would defend truth even if they have to lay down their lives for it. The promises of falsehood and the allurements of the world would not make them deviate from the right path. But, after all this, right? But as soon as the circumstances change and the time of making sacrifices for truth arrives, their mental attitude changes. Fear and poor spirit take the place of courage, doubt, and hesitation, that of faith and polytheism, and treachery, that of sincerity. The liars are not only those who have no intention of siding with truth and opposing falsehood, even before the time for the test arrives, but liars are also those whose condition changes at the time of divine test. And what they consider falsehood today was considered truth by them till yesterday. Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, thank you very much for staying with us till the end of today's episode of A to Z. Don't forget to log on to our website at parstoday.com, Call of Islam page. We leave you all in the care of Allah. Till next time, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
But anyone stay here won't be alive tomorrow. You can save yourself tonight and go. A deep silence filled the air.
On the news box.
Venezuela's government and the opposition began a new round of talks to end a years-long political impasse and economic crisis in the Latin American country on Friday in Mexico City. The two sides signed a memorandum of understanding containing the roadmap that will guide the dialogue process. The dialogue is mediated by Norway and hosted by the Mexican government. The government of President Nicolas Maduro has called for the lifting of the sanctions imposed by the United States and Europe against Venezuelan officials and institutions. On the other hand, the opposition has demanded the government to release dozens of people it considers as political prisoners and provide guarantees that they can run in the regional elections due in November. In addition, they have requested the government to allow humanitarian aid, including COVID-19 vaccines, to enter the country. In 2019, the Venezuelan government abandoned talks that took place in Barbados and Norway after the U.S. stepped up sanctions against the Maduro administration. In 2016, the Vatican supported similar talks that also failed. Furthermore, the plan for recent talks ran into trouble when the government rejected one of the opposition's envoys. Representatives of President Maduro refused to take part in the meeting if the opposition leader Juan Guaido's ambassador to Washington remained on the delegation. Venezuela says the U.S. sanctions are responsible for the country's current economic crisis.
That is the number one issue facing Venezuelans, because the sanctions are designed to break the Venezuelan economy and cause hunger on a mass scale. So if that can be challenged and pushed back even by a small bit, that would be incredibly important for all Venezuelan people. So I think these are fair parameters to go into the negotiations with. These are fair conditions, and the fact that the opposition is now coming to the negotiating table is a sign that they haven't got too many other options. This is, you know, after 2 years of trying to launch coups, calling for invasions, that they're now looking at the peaceful route is enormously positive, I think.
Washington and several of its Western allies have backed opposition leader Juan Guaido and imposed crippling sanctions on Venezuela in a bid to oust President Nicolas Maduro. The government says it won't bow down to what it calls blackmail by the United States in the upcoming talks. Venezuela descended into political turmoil after opposition figure Juan Guaido unilaterally declared himself as the interim president in January 2019. He claimed that Maduro's re-election in 2018 was fraudulent. The Trump administration recognized Guaido as the legitimate leader of Venezuela and publicly pursued a regime change policy.